generally in our life, and a meditation retreat is no different. It's life, as I was saying the other day, under the microscope. So generally, in this situation or any other, we tend to have one very central preoccupation. It's way out ahead of all the other things we think about. Me. Me. Me, me, me. And my meditation and my practice and my problems and my future and my issues and my relationships and my problems and my experience and my lunch and my. That's what we're really interested in. Me. There's a whole universe out there populated by people. You lot. And right in the center of it, look for yourself, life stretches out in every direction, and right in the middle, me. We're kind of famous to ourselves. So, understandably, it all seems to be happening here. Right? It is all happening here, all our experience, right here. So, in a way, and we could say that this is the kind of this is the burning question of any kind of inner work, of any kind of spiritual journey or path or practice that anyone's ever undertaken. Ultimately, the whole question of that is, what is this? What is this that I call me? What's the relationship, we could say, to frame it a little differently, between the here-ness that informs all my experience, the undeniable truth that everything is happening here. Try having an experience that's not here. No. Any experience, it doesn't matter if it's past or future, any memory, where does memory appear? Here. Where does some plan for the future appear? Here. Where does the thought of somewhere else appear? Here. Try and be somewhere else. Oh, go there. Oh, it's here. So another way of framing that exploration is to look at the relationship between the undeniable truth, and this, please don't take this as an idea, but in fact as you listen, try and stay in touch with the here-ness of your experience, the here-ness of sitting, the here-ness of seeing, the here-ness of hearing. The relationship between the undeniable truth of here-ness and what we take that to be, or what we take ourselves to be. And it requires lots of things. It requires courage to face the immediacy, the here-ness, the now-ness, the like-this-ness of our experience. It takes patience, it takes sensitivity, it takes willingness to face our experience so well, so brightly, so interestedly, so caringly, that we can start to actually see what this is, this field of experience, this medium of experience, that we usually refer to as me. So I'd like to look a little bit and see what does that mean? What do we mean by that? Is it possible, and the suggestion is that it's very possible, that we've got some or many quite strange or mistaken, strange and mistaken, ideas about what this is, about who I am. And I think it's important, if we're going to really investigate what this is, who I am, what the nature of experience is, what the nature of the experiencer is, that we start off from the point, with the idea that we don't know. If we already know, if we're already convinced that we know what this is, well, there's nothing left to learn. Like Suzuki Roshi said, in the mind of the expert, there are very few possibilities. In the mind of the beginner, many possibilities. So he encouraged what he called don't know mind. Common, everyday mind doesn't tend to be don't know mind. We seek a lot of security. We seek familiarity. We seek certainty. We love certainty, even though it's a kind of false certainty usually. So we tend to have a lot of ideas about who I am. If I asked you to just say, I am, dot, 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 and fill in the dots, you could probably go on all afternoon, I am like this, I am like that, I am. No? We have ideas based on gender, based on history, based on age, based on body image, based on a kind of intellectual view of ourselves, based on our capacities, based on our roles, based on our occupation or profession, based on our education, based on our religion. So we have to be willing in some way to put aside some of our certainties in order to look very closely. So everyday mind tends to rely on the kind of certainties of I am. It seems to be, if we look with not very close attention, if we look with habitual view, the view we've become accustomed to over decades, it seems self-evident. I am, you know, this we say. We'll speak about that a little more in a moment, but we might say, I'm this, meaning this body, meaning this mind, meaning these thoughts. But it seems, if we don't investigate closely, to be kind of self-evident that there's something here that I call me, that I call Martin, that I call who I am. A lot of the contemplative or spiritual traditions point to that not being so. But because it's hard for any human mind to hold true ambiguity, true not knowingness, true willingness to look afresh and see, we easily can end up in the other view. And the Buddhists are terrible for this, ending up saying, oh, there's nothing here. There's not a self. I wonder if, you know, some of you, if you've had the misfortune to get a kind of Buddhist brainwashing, may have ended up with the view that there's no self. Incidentally, if you're confused by what I just said, when the Buddha was asked, as he was once very directly by someone, for goodness sake, spit it out. Is there a self or isn't there? He refused to answer.
Why?
What? Because he didn't want to fall into the problem of reifying, there is, or into the absurdity of denying, there isn't. And usually, that's all everyday mind can grasp. There is or there isn't. It is or it isn't. We have a very, it's impossible in fact for rational mind to understand a being in a different way than either something existing or not existing. Well, my suggestion is that we suspend the kind of neurotic need for certainty that has to go to it is or it isn't, there is or there isn't, right? Which is why the Buddha stayed silent. And we just look and see what we find. So part of what I'd like to do is point to some of the things we look and see and find. And part of what I'd like to do is encourage you all in an exercise to look and see and find. It reminds me, this is a little bit of a digression, but it reminds me of this the famous line of Shakespeare, you know, to be or not to be, that is the question. So that was translated into Japanese. I don't know how what it is in Japanese, but then it was translated, the line was translated back from Japanese without reference to the original English. You understand what I mean? Without knowing the to be or not, they just got the line in English, translated it back into, in Japanese, back into English, and it came out as, it is or it isn't, isn't it? To which I would say, no. So, can we be willing, and it's an uncomfortable place to be, like I say, we seek certainty. You know what it's like when you hear a sound and you don't know what it is, and you feel, oh, what is it, what is it? We want to know. And there's a very strong momentum of needing to know to establish some kind of security. And partly that the insecurity of not knowing is based on some deep, deep knowing that the usual way we know is a bit faulty. So, if we're willing to start with the fact of the kind of fresh look that says, I don't know. What is this? I don't know. Then we start to look at the way the sense of self, the sense of who I am, the sense of what this is, shows up. Where does it show up? How does it show up? What does it latch onto? Sometimes it latches onto this body, right? Sometimes we say, I am, and the senses, this is important, just to stay with the here-ness as you're listening and see if you can track in your own experience. Sometimes the sense of self, of who we are, arises in conjunction with or as the body. So, somebody brushes past us and we say, oh, you knocked me, right? He hit me, he touched me, she caressed me, whatever it might be. So the sense of touch, and so the me, the sense of who I am, has landed in, not just in, but as the body. Me is coming up as the body. But interestingly, in some other moment, we talk about my body. There's a very significant shift there from self as body to self as the owner of the body. And that's a bit weird. Right? The fact that we can have this, a clear sense of who I am as this, you touched me, but then a moment later, we've taken ourselves to be something different. An entity that is the owner of, that has a body. My body. My leg hurts. So then we might say, well, oh, self's shown up as something else. What's this that self's shown up as? It's shown up as something that has a leg. Right? My leg. Oh, what's that? So then we notice that self sometimes shows up as mind, as something kind of intangible, something we can't point to, something we can't find mind. We seem to persist in some strange way of thinking that it lives up here somewhere. It's all my mind. Although it's interesting that if you speak with an East Asian person, an Indian or a Thai, or a Nepali or a Burmese person, or a Tibetan, they say, oh, my mind. My mind. And they point to their chest. We say, oh, my mind. Point to our heart, our head. So sometimes self appears, the sense of me appears as mind being the owner of the body. But are you waiting? Is this to ask a question? Okay, I just want to wait for the sound to go up. And I just finished this piece. But sometimes mind arises differently, as not as mind, but as, again, a different entity, as the owner of mind. We talk about my mind. My mind, these thoughts are going through my mind. I'm noticing my mind. Right? So then, oh, me has latched onto something else. It's starting to be a bit tricky to think what that thing might be that I'm calling I. If it's not body, we say my body. If it's not mind, we say my mind. What is it? What is it that's here that thinks it has a body, thinks it has a mind? What could it be? Now, please ask your question.
Mm. So now I am angry. It's my anger.
Right.
So, relate to self, self or not self, where is there a border or not between feeling, just as there is or not border between body, parsha, self or not self?
Well, it's a good question. I'm not sure I could repeat it, actually. But it was something to do with borders and boundaries between, you know, body and mind and feelings and a sense of self. So that's in a way part of what this investigation is. We seem to think there's boundaries. We seem to think we can separate body, mind, my mind. We seem to think we can separate even bits of the body, my leg, right? And yet, we might well ask that question, where, if anywhere, can we find a boundary, a border? Where can you find where body ends and mind begins? For that matter, where can you find where mind ends and world begins? Just as you look now, right? Mind receiving the images of seeing, where does mind end and world begin? We could stay here for another week at least. Just, never mind any more teachings. Let's just wonder about that. Where does mind end and world begin? If you can find somewhere, if you can find a border, well, you can't. Sometimes sense of self appears in this way and in that way, as body or as the owner of body, as mind or as the owner of mind, or sometimes self appears as some particular quality of mind, like a friend just pointed to. I am angry. I am angry. I, who I am, what I am, is angry. Angry isn't something that we are. Angry is a momentary coming together of a whole bunch of ever-changing conditions. some movement of heat, some movement of reaction, some movement of memory, some movement of what we're wanting or hoping or expressing. And very quickly, that's changed to something else. When we say, oh, I am sad. As if sad is who we are. So the identification in the moment, right, which gives some, which is happening as a changing process of here-ness, we could say, we start to see, if we explore it, not just in the ideas that I'm presenting, but hopefully as we explore it in our experience, that what's happening is that a sense of self that's actually unfindable and unlocatable, a sense of self is appearing and identifying with different aspects of our experience. It's identifying with a sense of place, it's identifying itself in time, and it's identifying itself in terms of borders, boundaries. We have very clear ideas at different times of where I stop and where other people or other things or world begins, even though that's unfindable. Spiritual teachings, and in fact our own deepening experience, and no doubt you have reference points for this yourself in different ways, start to both expand and dissolve that familiar sense of self. If we don't pay any attention, if we don't study ourselves in any way, what tends to happen for most people is that the sense of self, which, as we've just seen, is very, very fluid and latches on to different aspects of our experience, the sense of self tends to get more and more and more rigidified, more and more ossified, more and more fearful of things that don't correspond to its kind of self-view. So what we could call conscious evolution, or spiritual growth, or inner development, or anything else you might like to call it, is challenging that view. And actually, what we start to find is that the sense of self, what gets included in the sense of what this is, or who I am, or what this medium of experience is, can both expand very, very much, and at the same time, sometimes dissolve very, very much. For example, In moments of real intimacy with another person, for example, the sense of border or boundary can sometimes get very, very thin, subtle, and sometimes seem to completely dissolve. That might be in the kind of intimacy, in sexual intimacy. It might be just in the quiet intimacy of a shared moment. It might be in the intimacy of looking in the eyes of another, for example. Sometimes in some sensitive, quiet moment in nature, for example. A sense of what's included in here-ness, in what this is-ness, what's included in my sense of experience can expand very, very much. We'll speak of communing. Commune, as one, feeling as one with nature, feeling as one with experiences in different ways. The common flavour of a genuinely expanding sense of who we are is the flavour of intimacy, or, to put more simply, is the flavour of love. Love expands our being. The opening of our heart, the opening of our being, the opening of our experience, lets more life in, lets us feel closer to, more involved in, more accommodating of, more dissolved in, more intimate with life, all of life. At the same time, deepening experience, as we explore the nature of being conscious, as we explore the sense of self and where it arises more and more, we also are confronted with what I've been calling the unfindability of self. That wherever we look, wherever we look at the sense of self that arises, we can't find it there. We can't find it there as body. You say, I have a body. We can't find it there as mind. You say, I have a mind. We can't find self as an object. And so there's a kind of seeming paradox there, that the sense of self can expand and limitlessly, in fact, and the sense of self can dissolve utterly. There's this most wonderful line by an Indian teacher, Nisargadatta Maharaj. It's a famous line, maybe you know it. He says, wisdom, which is the flavour of the unfindability of self, a wisdom that recognises that self doesn't exist where the sense of self arises. He says, wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love, the expansive movement, tells me I'm everything. Between these two, my life flows. Remember it. Write it on your fridge door. Contemplate it every day. Wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love tells me I am everything. Between these two, my life flows. Between these two, seeming paradoxes, the seeming paradox of simultaneous everything and nothing, the simultaneous paradox of is and isn't. So where does that leave us? In our own experience, we may have some reference points to both the expanding movement of love and the dissolving, unfindableness of wisdom. But often what we're left with, if we just confront right now, in the immediacy of our experience, a sense of who we take ourselves to be, we find a lot of self-images, ideas about self that we tend to believe in. And it's the belief in them that makes our experience seem limited, contracted, and in negotiation, or in a sense of separation from the rest of life. You know, that image I gave at the beginning of life stretching out in each direction and this thing of me at the center of it. Well, the fact that, you know, everybody thinks they're the center. It's not really that I'm the center, right? But actually, how could we be? How could we be separate from life? Look, what's this? If it's life. It's this particular expression of life. So, we start to see, and in a way I'd like to just recap the last few days, that the images we have of ourselves, the ideas we have about who we are firstly impermanent. They're changing all the time. I think of myself in this way and in that way. I think of myself as body, and I think of myself as mind. I think of myself as angry. I think of myself as sad. Right? I think of myself as good, then I think of myself as bad. I think of myself as right, I think of myself as wrong. And I tend to, even though it's changing all the time, I tend to believe it each time. when I say, oh, I'm wrong, we feel crushed by feeling wrong. It feels like, in that moment, like it's the truth of who we are. And then we forget all about that when somebody praises us and we say, oh, I'm right. And we kind of fill out into, I'm right. And then we try and hold on, I'm right. As if we can hold on to that as the truth of who we are. So that actually the truth about self-image is that they're impermanent. Hopelessly impermanent. Constantly changing. And the second truth about self-images is that we suffer over them. That we suffer in terms of the measuring of ourselves as this or that. Which inevitably leads to suffering in terms of measuring how we could be, how we should be, how we ought to be. And rejecting all the bits that don't fit in. Rejecting the bits that seem unacceptable. The bits that don't fit the self-image we think we ought to have. And the Buddha pointed to three main characteristics of all experience. Firstly, chasar kviyot. Choser kviyot. I kviyot. The characteristic of the ever-changing nature, the ungraspable nature, the fluid nature, the impermanent nature of experience. Secondly, the painful affect of experience when we cling to it, when we make demands around it, when we defend against it, when we distract from it. Incidentally, I've posted the 3 C's and 3 D's after a few notes you wrote me. So if you want to write them down, they're there. Anicca, the Pali word the Buddha used for impermanent. Dukkha, the Pali word the Buddha used for the suffering, born of the clinging. And anatta, the Pali word the Buddha used for this characteristic of insubstantial, lacking in any inherent essence. Very badly translated as no self. Atta means immortal kernel. What literally means kernel. Do you know that English word, kernel? It's like in a nut. Garein. Okay. So atta means that garein. Okay. And it was used, that word was used in Hindu teachings prior to or around the time of the Buddha to suggest that there was a kernel, a soul, a kernel of a soul, a permanent immortal something inside of us. And the Buddha refuted that sense of rigid self. But the flavor or the meaning of anatta means substanceless. Essenceless, unfindable, insubstantial. So, pointing to experience, not as a philosophy, but as something for us to explore in our experience, the suggestion is that our experience is impermanent, that we suffer when we cling to it, and that there's a substanceless, ungraspable nature to what's happening. And that in recognizing those qualities, the expansion and the dissolution, the freedom of participation in this vast field of existence gets revealed more and more clearly and most significantly, more and more freely. So, we've been inquiring into impermanence, inquiring into suffering. So I'd like us to do an exercise this afternoon to inquire into our sense of self. First question then. Tell me a self-image you have. Tell me a self-image you have. So, of course, one could come up with very, very many self-images, and one could come up with a lot of quite safe self-images. I'm a man. Thank you. Tell me a self-image you have. I've got curly hair. Thank you. Tell me a self-image. Feel free to start with whatever comes. But my encouragement, you know, if you want to get the most out of this exercise, is to not just look for what you already know, but actually really listen to the question. Really let it in and look and see. Look and see. What self-image am I caught in or invested in now? What self-image might I be trying to present or show or demonstrate or convince the other person of? That's a lot of the way self-image shows up, is in what we're trying to present. So, you know, the more you can really let yourself be drawn into the unknown territory of this, the more you can not censor your answers, the more you can just dare to let all your self-images out, the more rich, the more benefit there can be in the exercise. Sometimes we might find self-images that feel kind of embarrassing or shameful even. And you have to see for yourself in the moment and in the exercise and with the person how safe you feel to reveal those. But what's very interesting about those things that seem embarrassing and shameful is that the more we keep them inside, the more the seeming embarrassment and shame is reinforced. The more we speak them out, the more they're revealed to be powerless. Yeah. It would certainly include body image, and for some, body image is a big part of self-image, right? But self-image is a lot more than just body image. So you might have a little bit of body, you know, there might be some body image in there, but my main encouragement would be to the kind of the inner sense of who you take yourself to be. Right? Tell me a self-image you have.
ספר לי על דימוי עצמי שיש לך. ספר לי או ספרי לי על דימוי עצמי שיש לך.
Could you hear that at the back, the Hebrew version? Yeah. For 10 minutes each. Second question. Who are you now? Who are you? No. Who are you right now? Who are you? Ahav.
עכשיו.
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 So.
מי את עכשיו? או מי אתה עכשיו?
מי אתה עכשיו? Who are you? מי אתה עכשיו? Who are you right now? And in this question, don't rely at all on what you think you know. Don't rely on self-image. But really look and see, what is this that's here right now? And if your answers seem to go way off the chart of the known, sail on. So the way we'll do that question is for 5 minutes each only, and then for another 10 minutes as a looping question. The second one, 5 minutes each, and then another 10 minutes, no, 15 minutes, as a looping question. So I'm going to repeat the times, okay? First question, tell me a self-image you have. 10 minutes. Second question, who are you right now? And for that one, you'll do 5 minutes each one. I ask you for 5 minutes, you ask me for 5 minutes. And then for another 15 minutes as a looping question, like we did a couple of days ago.
Can you demonstrate it?
Yeah. Thank you. Okay.
I think the first question is 10 minutes each.
Yeah. So, 10 minutes each, yes. Go ahead. Well, it's true, it's a mysterious question in some ways, right? What we've been exploring in some ways is that a lot of who we take ourselves to be doesn't really stand up to real examination. So let yourself be confronted by the mysteriousness of the question and see what comes. We're asking, who are you right now? Thank you. Who are you right now? So you've got some time, no? This is the 5 minutes and then 15 minutes. So you may go through layers of confusion. I don't know how to answer that. What do you mean? Okay, that's fine. Thank you. Who are you now? And each time, just let yourself really receive the question as fully as you can and see what comes. You don't have to rehearse now. Don't try to think, who am I going to be? Who am I going to be when I get asked a question? Right? So if you don't know, that's fine. Who are you now? I don't know. That might well be there at some point in the inquiry. Okay. So 10 minutes each for the first question, that's 20 minutes, and then 5 and 5 and 15, 25, 45, a little bit of time will do. So please, who are you right now? Okay. There are two questions. There isn't a third, but the second question you do for 5 minutes each and then for 15 minutes. The second question you do for 5 minutes each, and then you carry on the second question, but in the looping form.
You had to do the mumbling.
Yeah, no, this is as much as you get. Okay, is that all clear now?
Yeah.
Good. So, please be back here at 6 o'clock. Do you need me to leave my clock at the front here, or is everybody okay for timing? Nobody needs. Okay, there'll be a bell at 5 to 6.
No, but
between that.
No. So please just take responsibility for timing yourselves. And if you need a clock, I'll leave a clock at the front here and you can sit near enough to the front so there won't be any bells. But please keep, you know, if you just stick to the time and don't spend time in between doing other things so that we can be back here at 6 o'clock and have time for some exploration together. Okay. Mm-hmm.